ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to Food for Thought, a podcast gab fest for a multiracial mix of queer writers gathered around the table to talk about sex, identity, culture, what we like to read, and who we like to read. Food for Thought. It's like a suppository for the butthole of the mind.
Oh my god.
And we all know. We
live
Tommy
at that
is addicted to suppositories.
I'm a little addicted to suppositories.
You should slide into the DMs offering to send Tommy suppositories.
Well, what happened was I had my first hemorrhoid of my life, and all of my friends have had them before, and they were just like, get these little things, and I was like, it was like, you know, popping in. I don't know, like a breath mint, but for my butt.
I name my hemorrhoids, and then I imagine that giving myself suppositories is just feeding my hemorrhoids, and they munch on them
until they're dead.
Oh my god! Now I'm just thinking of little Pac-Man, like munching
exactly.
Your little butt.
Exactly.
I can't.
I was like, we lost John today.
Frequent are you? You know what, actually, I don't want to talk about this anymore. I am Tommy Teves Pico. I'm an Indigenous American poet, screenwriter, single and actively mingling. And I'm just wondering what predatory animal came to Los Angeles and ripped the knees out of literally everyone's jeans.
It's so true. Why does no one have knees in their jeans?
Nobody has knees in their jeans.
It's fucked up.
Yeah.
It's like we're stuck in 2007.
Yeah.
I'm Fran, I'm a writer, I'm an editor, I'm a Lime LaCroix, but a Pamplemousse LaCroix Rising.
Wow, that is...
Pamplemousse?
Pamplemousse.
I don't know if you understand it, because it's French.
It's French. Je vais faire le reste du spectacle en français.
Je verrai, baba.
Je ne parle pas français. I'm Dennis Norris II, and I'm a reader and a writer, a lapsed violist, and I am writing high on Sudafed and Rosé.
That's a good combo.
It's
a good combo.
We are like the whitest spring break ever.
I mean, truly my brand.
And I am Joseph Osmondson, scientist, nonfiction writer, and you guys, as Dennis would say, you guys, I graduated summa cum laude from Skidmark College.
Wow, really you are fired.
I'm really not helping. Not helping at all. Oh my god.
I don't have anything to say.
Ben has been stunned into silence. Is that going to impede you from telling us what we have on the menu this evening?
That's right. Today we are talking all about poetry, or hoetry, as I like to call it.
If you will.
We decide whether or not Virginia Woolf is a top.
Spoiler alert.
Hey. For our second segment, we literally don't know what it is yet because we're recording in advance, you bitches. And for dessert, let's just say it's giving Tommy an erection right now.
Hi, how's it going? Tommy here. I think it's time we start the top of the show the way any good top should, but a little tease. Our uproarious appetizer segment, Amuse Bouche. And to amuse our bouches, Fran's got a little game.
That's right. Today we are playing a very literary edition of Top Secret, wherein we take some dynamic duos and decide who is the top. And of course, a little PSA for all of our listeners. We at Food for Thought LLC do not believe that, you know, positions need to be binary. You don't have to be a top, anything, you know,
right,
what I mean?
Yeah,
but sometimes talking about bottoms is just like a funny punchline. And that's why we're playing this game. So let me tell you, this is the literary edition because we're talking about poetry.
Oh no.
Literary duos, y'all. Okay. Ready to play? Mm-hmm. Who is the top? Virginia Woolf or Vita Sackville-West?
I picture Virginia Woolf as being a very vengeful top.
Whenever I think about them, I just can't stop thinking about the fact that, like, if they got married, and one of them took each other's names, it would be Virginia West or West, comma, Virginia.
Oh.
Isn't that fucked up?
I just think Virginia Woolf wants to get plowed in a room of her own.
I pegged her as a peg.
Alex spat out her beer in the back.
Oh my God. Done.
Dennis?
I think that Virginia Woolf is largely a bottom, except for when she takes you to the lighthouse. And there she's going to absolutely plow your brains out by the water.
Wow, love that literary reference.
It's my favorite Virginia
Woolf
book.
Lighthouse dildo, perhaps? Lighthouse dildo?
Lighthouse sized dildo?
I don't think that's possible.
Who is the top?
Truman Capote and Harper Lee.
Oh,
because they were friends in real life.
Wow. Yes, Truman Capote is
the most bottom.
100%.
Absolutely Harper Lee.
So Harper Lee is a quiet
absolutely.
Top.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, Secret Mommy Top. Yes.
Secret
yes.
Mommy
yes.
Top.
No.
Yes. Oh, just like Jada Pinkett Smith.
Yes. 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 Truman Capote top. Is like so loose that like when he walks, he goes.
He like literally can motorboat through the water. sucking water in and propel it and
disgusting.
There's in all seriousness, there's a really incredible Hilton Alls essay on Truman Capote in White Girls that describes his sort of bottomness, actually.
We will be editing that out.
Anyway.
Wow. Who is the top? J.R.R. Tolkien or C.S. Lewis?
Oh my God.
Was C.S. Lewis Christian?
Very Christian.
And they were best
yes,
friends
yes,
IRL.
Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, okay.
They would like go on gay like writing dates together.
Gay they because were like, they were gay or gay because writing is gay?
Writing is so gay. And they were maybe closeted faggots, but.
I think there's so much about J.R.L. Tolkien, the One Ring, I'm thinking butthole.
I feel like the whole point is that they're searching for the right cock to put the ring on.
And was C.S. Lewis the Lion, the Witch in the Wardrobe?
Absolutely.
Yes. Closet case 100%.
100%. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, closet.
Yes, we get it.
I mean, the way he would describe Aslan, King Aslan.
Mm-hmm. Who is the top? The Bronte sisters. I mean, again,
Emily.
Just a general evergreen note. It's not incest if you're gay. So we all know. Hero Food for Thought, LLC, we believe.
We'll put that in the merch later. We'll have like a bumper sticker that says it's not incest if you're gay.
I do think Emily was the top.
For sure.
I agree.
Really?
100%.
Because, well, actually, you know what? A lot of her shit was about, like, it was like sadomasochistic, like relationships.
Yeah.
So maybe not. Maybe it's just kind of like she's a switch. Maybe they're both, you know, kinky switches.
So, like, the story is, like, Emily was, like, a totally, like, a social, like, hated being around people, just, like, wandered around and then died early.
Damn, why stop looking at me when
epic.
You say
that? Just, she wanted to be pounded into ground beef by, like, some cow hand, you know? Total bottom.
Okay. Cow
Who
hand.
Is the top? Allen Ginsberg or Jack Kerouac?
Allen Ginsberg is 100% the biggest bottom in American history.
Yeah. A big
Jack. Howl at that ass. Yes.
He's got
yes.
a fat ass.
Howl at that ass.
Absolutely. Oh, my God.
But he has kind of that daddy, that big beard, the white hair. But
he's the daddy who wants you to plow him, though.
But that was the thing. I think he was the kind of like one of the preeminent like hard femme, you know what I mean?
True,
like the
true,
butch
true,
femme,
true,
you know?
True,
like
true.
I mean, I'm co-opting that term because that comes from lesbian culture, but like you know what I mean? Like he had like the beard, but he was like the faggot bear, you know?
Yeah, faggot bear.
Maybe I'm Rasputin, maybe I'm not.
Yeah,
like
yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? And also like Jack Kerouac, I think Jack Kerouac was one of those like straight dudes who was like gay on the holidays.
You know, so your ideal man, Tommy.
Why don't we stop talking about
because
me?
Then you'd only have to have sex like a few times a year.
Oh, moving on. The next couple is
Gertrude Stein and Alice Toklas.
Alice B. Toklas. Yes, Alice B. Token for sure.
Yeah.
She gets high. Let me tell you, the ladies get high.
Gertrude has always read as a top.
Top 100%. Yes, absolutely. Don't you think so?
Joe knows.
Yeah.
More. You read her work more.
I mean, yeah. I mean, she just
did
has that.
Did she flick that tender button? Would you say?
God.
Thank you. I wish she would flick my tender butt.
My old hard calloused button.
James Baldwin and Lucas Habersberger. His like Swedish lover.
Yeah. Right. James is a bottom, right?
I always thought so.
Yeah.
I thought so too.
I think James was a bottom. And also, you know, he like many of us, was addicted to the white peen.
I think that he had a lot of
I'm making fun of him, even though he's created the blueprint for how we literally talk about race like today.
Yeah, he's
amazing and wonderful, but you know, you can poke some fun, James.
Absolutely,
you
know, Jimmy, absolutely the bottom,
Jimmy.
Yeah, it was like face down, ass up in Giovanni's room for
every time.
Sylvia Plath or Anne Sexton?
Sylvia Plath was 100% a bottom. She wanted to be taken care of. She wanted to be held. She wanted to have an arm around her and a dig in her butt. And Anne Sexton is doing nothing but fucking people. Motherfucking Sexton. You know what I mean? It's like the truth the dead know is that she fucked them to death. Yes, 100%.
I wish you were still alive to fuck me to death. Yes, go on.
What do you think, Joe? You were a contemporary Sylvia Plath, but like less talented?
Yeah, way, way less talented. And I'm like way too lazy to even kill myself. I'm so sorry.
We love you, Joel.
Love yourself.
Opening the oven sounds like so much work.
You're that Dorothy Parker poem about like nooses give, might as well live. Yeah.
Oh my God. It's a perfect position, though, I'm just going to say.
Wait, head in the oven?
That's so fucking funny. Oh my God.
What's your favorite position?
On your hands and knees.
You get real quiet and you're like, get
on
this.
Your hands and knees.
I love to be ass up, head
in the
oven, gas on. That's right.
It's like an industrial size popper. It's like an oven. It's like the gas.
Oh my God, that should be your favorite way.
Gas on, ring off. Yeah.
Imagine how open your anus will be when you die.
Oh my God. Well, yes, you release.
Yes.
Are you talking about the fact that when you die, your bowels lose their like?
Yes,
muscle?
Yes, that's what we're talking about.
Just wanted to clarify that.
Oh my God.
From the doctor.
Wow, we are trash.
Oscar Wilde and Alfred Douglas.
Oscar Wilde was 100% the biggest bottom, right?
He was the one that got, like, you know, he went to court because he was gay.
Yes, but he fucked a ton of rent boys and shit like that.
Did he really?
He was kind of daddy.
I kind of thought he was, like, kind of like a femtop daddy.
No, I've never seen a photo of
Alfred Douglas?
No, I have not. I don't know what he looks like.
He's cute. He is, like, the Timothy Chalamet of yore. He's like a teeny tiny little baby.
Well, there you go.
I mean, I just feel like Oscar Wilde gets a little too off on his own puns, and that just reads epically bottom to me.
Oh, that is
looking directly at Tommy.
Was it he on his deathbed and he said, "Either these drapes go or I do"?
I thought it was the wallpaper, but yes, his last words.
100% still in his powers.
On that note, thank you all for playing that wonderful game of Top Secret. For our next segment, we have a...
I mean, do not try this at home, kids. Yeah. Kind of story
from a one Tommy Tebspico. So truly, like legally, I'm obligated to tell you to please not try this at home. Tommy, take it away.
Your impure thought stories are like Jackass set to gayness in 2019.
How I broke my toe at the top of 2020. Oh, my first sex injury of the year. Mm-hmm. Now, this is an OTL part two story, I have to say, because it was with, you know, OTL part one is a story that I told earlier in the season. OTL part two, I was back in his hometown of
Baltimore. Yeah.
Yes, it was Baltimore. We were all in Baltimore.
OTL stands for
One True Love. Oh. And there was this thing that happened where, like, it had been a while since we hooked up. Because the first time we hooked up was, like, I think 2017 or something. It happened like that for a while. And there was more than a year of us just, like, either, you know, he was in a relationship, I was in a relationship. He wasn't the best communicator, I'll tell you that much. But to the point where I was like, did I make this thing up?
Right.
Did this thing happen in my head? Yeah, did the moment pass?
Was it your one fake love? love?
Was it actually fake? Ooh, yeah, you know, yeah. did it only occur to me? And so we're hanging out in
Baltimore.
Oh, yeah, love that.
We're hanging out in Baltimore. It's right. Hometown of Baltimore.
Right.
And we decided to go see a movie. And afterwards, we got some pizza. We was talking for like 4 or 5 hours.
Wow, pizza before love interaction.
I didn't
brave.
Think it was going to go that way.
Talking okay. for four That's or five why. Hours sounds yeah. miserable.
And for our Moira Rose interpretation yes, of the word, yes, 100%. And I kind of like, you know, we were talking, it was just like, I remembered the ease of our communication, like the style of like his humor and how we just kind of melded and interacted and we moved on. And it just was so one of those things where like 5 hours happened and it felt like 5 minutes. And yeah. We were walking back to my Airbnb and we just kind of sit outside. And the thing is, on the hill up to the Airbnb, he started dropping these things that I sort of remembered from the first time that we hooked
up. Like
little
hints.
Little like, and so-and-so is saying like, you don't make out with boys, but I mean, they don't know that, you know, I kind of make out with boys now. And I was like,
what?
Things of that nature. Mm-hmm. And so we get to the top of the hill and, you know, it's been like 4 beers into it. So I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to try this thing.
Oh.
And so we hug and it's like, we kind of look at each other and then in a split second, it was just like animalistic fucking making out, biting each other, like hands up shirts and down pants and on bulges and like choking. He was choking me.
Blood
so
flying
hot.
Everywhere.
The thing is, we talk all the time about, oh, I want The Rock to like jump on me until I'm ground beef or whatever. Like, oh, I want Jason Momoa to Munchausen by proxy me for like 8 literal years until we become the next serial podcast or whatever. But that's literally how it felt. Where I was like, he was like, I just want to fucking like fight fuck you. And I was like, I want to eat you to death. Like, and then like but then we take a break because it's, you know, we
just otherwise you would die.
Yeah. And then he was just like, man, like, I just like, you are it from like, you just, I've had a crush on you since the first time we hung out.
Primordial crush.
And I don't know what to do with it because like, this has never happened before. I've made out with dudes, but I never had a crush on a dude. And I was like, well, and but the thing is, like, I have never known this person to be so forthcoming in terms of like how they talk. I've noticed them to be very forthcoming in their body occasionally, but like in this conversation, I wouldn't say that like that it was always necessarily inward focused. Like, he was very able to talk about culture, pop culture, art, poetry, anything. But when it came to something interrogative and earnest, there wasn't that type of dialogue. This was like the first actual conversation about the two of us that we'd ever literally had.
Wow. Right, right.
The first time that we hooked up, we went to breakfast the next morning. We were talking about, like, I don't know, jazz cigarettes, like whatever.
Jazz
like,
cigarettes. Isn't that what you just call like a cigarette that has a little weed in it?
That's what we call them. Yes. And I had to contend with the fact that, like, I had felt the same way, and I was like, I don't know how this is going. I don't know where this will lead. I don't know what this means for the future. But he was like, I've been telling my friends. I think I'm going to tell my, like, I'm not going to get into that much of the business because I don't want anybody to figure out who this is. But it was so processy, intimate process.
What do you mean by that?
Like, he really put his cards on the table and was like, this is how I feel about you. And I was like, yes. Yeah. And I was like, this is how I feel about you. And then 4 hours of the most vigorous animal fucking of my entire life.
Wow.
Then the next day I go to karaoke with Den. We're hanging out, doing whatever. And I'm like, I got to get back and go to sleep. Because like, the text messages had started. And Dennis was like, we were supposed to sing karaoke. This is the only thing that gets me from singing karaoke. Because Dennis and I had signed up to sing Back to Black by Amy Winehouse. And I was gotta go. And Dennis was like, no, we're supposed to sing. And I was like, gotta go sleep. And
I knew it.
So then I get back to the Airbnb.
We're going back to get plaid by OTL.
And we basically do this number two. Like, we do it again. Wow. The next. But here's the thing.
You do this number two.
Okay, no, we don't do that.
You mean round.
Round two.
But the thing, here's the thing. I hate my feet. So when I'm with a gentleman caller, I generally wear socks.
And even when you're fucking.
I wear socks. And they were very soft. They were buttery socks, I would say.
Oh. No, why would you say that?
The next, why, they the glow feel up? So got, good. No. And I was walking down. It was like the next morning. I was walking downstairs to get like a glass of water or some shit. And I, my soft buttery socks and the varnish of the stairs were just like, and in 1 second, I knew I was taking a spill.
Yeah.
And I'd remembered Joe's story from 2 days earlier about how Joe slipped and fell on the steps at the bathhouse.
In Puerto Vallarta.
Because he wasn't wearing sticky shoes and had fucked up his back. And I was
fell
just like
so hard on my back. And luckily it like bruised and it hurt for like 2 weeks. But it didn't, I was so worried it would like fuck up my spine. I remember my mom had a fall. She had to be about the age that I am now. And I remember like for 2 years, her back was fucked up. You know, when you fuck up your back.
Yeah. It takes a long time if it ever comes back fully. Yeah.
And so I was just like in that split second where I knew I was taking the tumble. I was like, secure the back, bitch.
Secure the back.
Just like a good bottom would. Okay.
And so I like I grabbed the rails really quick and I saved my back. Like I hit it a little bit, but like I saved myself. But then on one of the steps, the toe next to my little toe just went the wrong way of all the rest of them.
No.
And there was Tommy has four toes now on that foot.
So this is a story all about how I got one toe amputated. No. But like I was so happy that I saved my back. And I was just like, the adrenaline, all that kind of stuff. I didn't even feel it until I got back upstairs. And I was like, the steps were hard. And I was like, no, something went wrong. But then there was this man in my bed. And I was like, do I go to the ER or do I stay in bed with this person for the next few hours? And I stayed in bed.
Wow.
And then I
had to I've been there. Do I go to the hospital?
I'm bleeding out, but I am cuddling someone right now.
But it was, you know, then I get back into bed and he puts his arm back around me and he's like, and he just like, you know, moans into my ear and I was like, I made the right choice. Like, I might have to amputate my foot, but I got it in.
You got it in?
Yeah. So thank you so much. That was my, how I got my third.
So this happened like a few days ago.
Yes, it did.
So your toe is still broken.
Yes, it's still broken.
As we speak.
Very much in pain. Swollen, bruised. But the thing is, like, Joe's mom is a nurse practitioner, and so I use her as my personal triage now. And she was just like, don't go to the doctor. I ain't going to do nothing for you. The doctor can do literally nothing for a broken toe. Just tape it to the next one and wait a couple weeks.
I love you, but you should get a second opinion.
My mother literally said, the prescription is a tincture of time.
No. Of course she did. That is gay. But
it's so
you know
gay.
What, Teebs? I appreciate that you made the choice in the moment, the strategic choice to protect your back. So that later on, it could be broken in the way that it should
that
be broken.
That it should be.
Okay.
That a back should be broken.
That a back should be broken.
Yes. Anyway.
Thank you so much for sharing in that moment with me.
This message comes from iHeartRadio sponsor, Mercury Insurance. If you're looking to save some money, you should really think about getting a quote from Mercury. Because Californians save an average of $677 with Mercury. It's quick and easy, and in just a few minutes, you might find you could save a lot of money on your auto and home insurance. Plus, Mercury was named one of America's best insurance companies by Insure.com 4 years in a row. Low rates, big discounts, great insurance. Go to MercuryInsurance.com today to get a quote.
So, for the meat of our discussion, the thought process spelled
T-H-O-T.
T-H-O-T. Me, Tommy Teebs, is going to be slinging you meat this week. So our topic is poetry.
Poetry.
And you know what I'm talking about? Like, listen, that's my job. That's what I do. That's how I make my living. That's what I tour on. I had my fourth book come out or whatever, but I fucking hate poetry so much. I do. I hate
Teebs.
It. I know. It's dumb, but I do. But the thing is, like, the thing is, I don't know if it's because of what poetry is or maybe the way that it's received or what it is versus the way that it is taught.
Or the construct within.
Yes. And there's like a real way in which like also this like idea that like that it's supposed to be lofty and talk about truth and use these beautiful words. And like, I just want to talk about bullshit and cuss. Like, so I don't understand like how I come into poetry or whatever. But the thing that I have to remember is that like poetry was never, for me, it was never something in the classroom. It was was something in my real life, in my lived existence. My parents love poetry. Like, they barely graduated high school, and they're on the res, right? But they love poetry. That's how they courted each other. They wrote poems to each other. Oh. My mother loved, like, Anna Akhmatova. My dad loved, like, Alfred Lord Tennyson, and they would, like, read to me. They would read to each other. No we had, way. Like, nights on Sundays where we would read poems. We basically had an open mic in my room, in my living room on Sundays.
Well, I can't believe you ended up the way you did.
Can yeah. you? It's so mysterious.
Yeah.
And so because of that, I never felt like what I understood was that what is required of reading a poem, it wasn't an education. It wasn't going into debt. It wasn't getting a master's. There were three simple ingredients to reading any poem, and that is time, attention, and curiosity. Mm-hmm. And if you have those three things, you can read literally anything.
Yeah.
But then it was this lofty idea that it had to be something taught to you that was always contentious for me, partly because, like, I have inherited generational trauma around being in a classroom, because that comes from my grandmother's generation, where they were all taken into boarding schools. They were all beaten, starved, stripped of their language, of their culture, of what it means to be Kumeyaay. And so it's like, obviously going into the situation of the classroom gives me a little bit of anxiety. But I did find ways of, like, really loving and appreciating, and poetry is honestly the only thing that can make me cry. Like, poetry and singing. But the thing is, like, poetry and music back in the day were the same thing. Mm, so it's like, right. It's only recently that they've kind of become estranged of each other.
Poetry and singing and Little Women, the movie.
Ooh, when Joe said, I love my independence, but I'm so alone. Oh, that hit.
Oh, my God, it's so
I
good.
Said no such thing.
Joe Marsh.
So I'm wondering, so that was my origin story of poetry. That's how poetry came to me. It was largely through my parents and not through school. I've taken one poetry class in my entire life. Yep. But but I understand how there can be a suspicion and an anxiety around poetry, and this idea that it is something sort of high-minded that you have to that is incapable of you of understanding, or that it is unknowable to a certain extent. So I'm curious how y'all have encountered, because we're all writers in here, we all are voracious readers, like, how have you encountered poetry in your life, and how, and maybe what were some of the pitfalls and anxieties and some of the pleasures of it?
Similar to you, Tommy, like, I did not totally love the construct of poetry that I found myself into. I took a lot of poetry classes in college, like, as an English major. It was my favorite thing to study, but it, like, as I kind of, like, you know, unpacked it more and more, I was like, oh, this thing is so classist. This thing is so elitist. This thing is so exclusionary. And then when I would talk about it with people, like, outside of poetry world, it was like I was speaking a foreign language. And I was is this useful? Like, if only a very small subset of, like, people who read actually feel emotional access to poetry, you know what I mean? Or physical access to poetry. But yeah, I've said this before, I'll say it again. Tommy's the first gay poet I'd ever heard of. You know what I mean? Aww. At least the one in the contemporary world. I remember falling in love with your work on Tumblr, and I remember seeing kind of, like, the rowdiness and the nastiness and the gay sex of it all, and being like, oh, like, something was kind of unlocked, because, like, I had read, you know, the gay poets of yore, per se, but, like, not in a contemporary sense. I never heard of a living gay poet.
Right, where the sex was metaphorical.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, Hart Crane
Walt
talking
Whitman.
About... Yeah.
Yeah,
and it's like...
Being like this, leaves of grass.
This
and
useless...
then Tommy's like, leaves of ass.
But the thing is, like, you read Hart Crane, and it's a very complicated way of saying, I came onto a thing of wallpaper, and then I felt very ashamed.
Right.
Like, that's his whole oeuvre, is, like, being ashamed about coming and thinking about men.
Yes. And that's what a lot of those texts are like that. The shame that comes with it. I mean, even, like, Baldwin and, like, Oscar Wilde and, like, all these other poets that, like, wrote about, you know, queer love in a way that was framed, obviously, in the context of its time. Like, not necessarily, like, saying, oh, fuck these writers, you know, fuck these writers that created the world of writing that we know it as today. Mm-hmm. But, like, I couldn't access it because it was not how I was feeling about my own queerness. And that's not how I, you know, wanted to feel.
And there's, like, a permission that somebody has to give you to write the way that you want to write, mm-hmm. or to express the way that you want to express, or to use, like, vulgarity or contemporary, or to use Twitter or something contemporary to be like, I'm not making poetry of your moment. Mm-hmm. I'm making poetry of mine. Mm-hmm. So it's going to contain contemporary elements. limits.
Right, right.
And actually, like, I, similarly to Fran, had a really, really hard time with contemporary poetry, in large part because I felt like it was hiding from me. Like, it was like a puzzle that needed to be figured out. And, you know, I think that there was a movement in 20th century American poetry with writers like John Ashbery to actually, like, literally make it so hard for the reader. And
right, we're talking about language poetry. We're talking about elliptical poetry.
Exactly.
We're talking about, like, movements that were in opposition to confessional poetry.
Right.
Exactly. And I think, you know, that made it really hard for me and made poetry feel inaccessible. What changed that for me was in 2014, I was a Lambda Literary Fellow in nonfiction, and that was a writing workshop that had poets there as well. And I was like, oh, I don't really read poetry. I don't really like poetry. And they introduced me to poets who were not doing that. Mm-hmm. Poets who I fell in love with. And that opened up the world to me. And now I read as much or more poetry than anything else. And actually reading more poets, it had invited me back into the world of folks like Ashbery. And what, you know, in hearing a little bit of the history of John Ashbery, he was gay and had to write such obscure poems because he had to hide all of his desire. Mm-hmm. He couldn't be like, I want to suck dick, right?
Meanwhile, one of his main bitches was Frank O'Hara.
Right, right,
in
right,
the
right,
New
right,
York
right,
school
right,
talk
right,
about,
right.
like, exactly. let your kids go to the movie theater so they can have gay sex.
Who was the top there, though?
Oh,
I think Frank O'Hara is an epic bottom.
Do you think? Yeah, well, I mean,
there are different ways of being a bottom. They could use a double sided dildo.
John Ashbery is a shameful top.
A shameful top. That is so
he's
true.
He's just like, this is the only he way just I does do it. This, the only way he can.
He comes in the butt and then cries.
Yeah. Oh, so that means you're not the first.
Indicting yourself, are we?
That's something that I really love about, you know, constructs like Lambda and, you know, the kind of non-elitist, like, literary, you know, space. That are taking emerging artists and that kind of that and who are contemporizing it, literally queering like the state of poetry, the state of literature as it is today, even though Lambda Literary did waitlist me 3 times. I mean, I'm really glad that Lambda Literary never accepted me, honestly, because then I would have become a writer.
Oh my god.
Who can you imagine? What a joke.
But the thing is, sometimes missed opportunities are an opportunity, in and of themselves.
Exactly.
Yeah. I didn't get the Poets House Fellowship in New York, and I remember thinking, like, I was a lock because I was like, show me 12 poets.
Poets
are in the game more than I am right now, because it was limited to people who lived in, like, the Tri-State area. And I made it to, there was like 15 semifinalists and they were going to accept 13.
I remember that. Yeah.
And I did not get it.
That's pretty brutal.
And
why did they even have the finalists?
And then we had to go into an interview, and I remember, like, in the interview I said something. They were like, so why do you love Poets House? And I was like, I mean, I like being in a place where I don't have to buy anything.
That's amazing.
I mean, that is hilarious.
New York City, that's fucking
that's,
real.
It really is.
Yeah, no, it is.
The truth.
Great for that.
Yeah, they don't even have a coffee shop.
Yeah. No, it's literally amazing.
But because I didn't get that, I ended up going on a writer's retreat through Brooklyn Poets, where I started IRL.
Wow.
There you go.
What is it about poems as opposed to other genres that make poems unique and special? Like, why, you know, do they affect, why, Tommy, you said poems are the only thing that make you cry. Why not an essay?
That's actually a really great distinction, I think, the crying thing. Because more often than not, when you read a poem and it makes you cry, you don't necessarily understand how.
No.
And right?
Like, I think
that's
of
kind of,
like,
the magic of it.
And I don't know that I'm going to when I start reading.
Right.
And
right,
I don't
right.
intend to. I don't think it's going to happen. And then I'm reading, like, Tim Lugos's poem about being in the AIDS ward.
Yeah.
And he's wondering how people are going to remember him as a... And I can't, like, it just does something. And, like, I feel the molecules inside of my body change in this way that, like, water comes from my eyes. What the fuck? or like, even, like, reading my own stuff out loud and I'm supposed to, like, perform it. And I get to lines where I'm just like, I can't say this without.
I've seen that happen to you. Mm-hmm.
And I don't intend to. And in fact, that's like, I try to be irreverent so that that other part won't happen. But it's like, the more I lean into the feelings, the more the feelings lean back into me.
Right. There's something unnameable, untouchable, intangible, ineffable, like, sublime about that that kind of, like, thing, that little, like, you know, you're like, oh. Like, I don't know what that is, but it is, like, you know, it's kind of like when we talk about the joy and the eroticism, that, that spiritual space. You hit that kind of space of, like, whatever the poem has accomplished, and you're like, ah.
Some kind of, like, I'm thinking of it kind of like, what do you call acupuncture? Mm. Like, yeah, something that opens
that's
up the things.
Such a good metaphor.
Yeah, where the little needles go in and like something gets opened.
How
up.
Did it do that?
Yeah.
Literally, you don't know.
So I mean, no. I definitely make everything worse, and you know, I think it's just the way my brain works, and it's probably why I'm a scientist as well. When I have a poem that does that to me, I read it again and again and again and try to understand why and how. Also because I'm a writer, and so I want to wield that magic myself, right? Mm-hmm. And I think for me, having read a lot of poems, mostly small poems, and I think we can talk about the difference, the joys of small versus long poems, but poems are incredible when they're bite-sized. So you read them in a very short period of time, right? So there's this emotional intensity. You sort of know that going into them. And then there's a huge tradition in poetry of something like a sonnet being a set number of lines. And sort of by definition, it has a premise and then turns that premise. There's what's called a volta or a turn. And so it sort of gives you a world and then disrupts that world. And I feel like that is part of the magic.
That's why a good joke and a good poem
exactly.
are so similar to each other because they turn that same way. They set you up for an expectation and then they're like, guess what, bitch?
And a lot of the time it's about timing. Rhythm, a beat. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Yep. It's about hitting a kind of space.
And I think for prose writers, we have so much to learn from poets because when you're writing something that's 14 lines of 11 syllables each, there's no spare space. You don't have a misplaced word. Every comma and capital is important. And I think that prose writers are really great at story, but sometimes we can lose that attention to rhythm of language and individual words and how words sound together. And poets are so good at that. You know, it's like, oh, where in your mouth does each word hit? You know, poems, I think, are really designed to be read out loud, and that sort of the orality of them and how it feels in your mouth and then how it feels for your ear to hear it is part of the magic of what they do. Sort of when you read prose, you're really not meant to even think every sound, right? That slows down your reading.
Because that's not the economy of that particular form.
Exactly.
That's not that genre. Like what poems have that others don't is just the words.
The words.
We don't get stories. We don't get characters. We don't get dialogue
necessarily. You do.
Necessarily. Like you don't come, like the thing is, I think oftentimes people come to fiction to be entertained. Mm-hmm. I think oftentimes they come to nonfiction to learn something. Mm-hmm. And I think oftentimes you come to poetry because you want to read. Like, that's what you get. You have to come to it wanting to read the words.
Yeah.
Wow. Because that's all we have. We have nothing else but the words.
Yeah. So as the only person at this table who does not write poetry, has never written poetry, and loves poetry deeply but has no intention of ever writing poetry, it's really, really interesting because in some ways, I feel like I see fewer distinctions between them as someone who's like just writes prose. So, and I think it all goes back to like my beginnings with poetry and with literacy. And for me, it all goes back to when I was like, before I could even read, when I was a very young kid, we had a tradition in my house. And at the end of the day, my mom would sit me on her lap in her super like old and ratty but very soft and comfortable and warm like reclining chair in my parents' bedroom. They had this like awful like textured pink wallpaper. It was the 80s. And she would read Bible stories to me. And she started off, I think, when I was very young with like the actual stories, but then eventually she got to the Psalms. And the way that she and my dad explained the Book of Psalms to me was that they explained this as verse that was like inspired by God, that was divine, and that was like in their minds kind of like the crown jewel of this like all important religious text that they were like bestowing upon me. And so, and then from there, when I got a little bit older, in my family, like, literacy was so important to my parents and to my older siblings to bestow upon me as well. And that was really like a political thing, like the importance of reading, the importance of writing. But poetry was a huge part of that. And so then eventually I became, for a while when I was very young, obsessed with Langston Hughes. And I felt like I didn't understand why I connected with him so much in his poetry when I was literally in like first, second, third grade. But to me, there are ways in which it sounded like the Psalms, even though if you look at them, they're like completely different. But to me, as a little kid, they sounded the same. But also I saw myself in them in some way. And I understood that there was this like hugely sort of historic, important purpose to me, like consuming these words and understanding them. And so the interesting thing as well for me is that like it never occurred to me to think about poetry as being something that was elitist until I got to college. Prior to that point, I thought of poems and poetry as something that everyone had access to, that everyone could engage in.
That they go to Sunday to hear read from every single week.
Yes, right. Literally. And it's not even like, I mean, I was growing up in Cleveland, like people weren't doing slam poetry in Cleveland in like 2002. But I just had this understanding that this was something that everyone
like a week
had.
From now we're going to get like a bunch of
Club
212
exactly.
doing motherfucking bullshit.
True.
I have a question for the group that you know all of the poets that we've talked about most recently, Langston Hughes, brings up. Why are all poets giant
bottoms?
Faggots?
Oh, I was
but same
bottoms.
It seems like more than other types of writers.
Even the straight ones are faggots.
Even the straight ones are faggots. Oh my god!
Poetry really is answer to that question.
No, I mean it as a serious question.
Yeah. I don't know.
Well, why what are you doing if faggots? Not if we're talking about what the word queer means?
Yeah.
And that it is to distort and dilate or disrupt a meaning. That is, I think, the goal. In a poem, it's not only to express, but it is also to choose the words that have the kind of verve that you want, like that makes a moment different than other moments.
If you think about the origin and root of the word faggot, not like the actual like syntactical meaning, but like if you think about what it means in differentiation to its counterparts, like homosexual or gay, you know. I think the difference in be a lot, there are a lot of differences, but when you think about what a faggot is, it has to be by default a failure. And something that I think it could be unique about poetry and about what it's the way that they might be similar is that both a faggot and a poet are preconditioned to fail. They must in order to do what
them's
they do.
Fighting
a poet
words.
Is disinterested in succeeding at literally anything. You don't write a poem because you're setting out to accomplish something. You don't write a poem because you're trying to communicate a message. If you're opening up a poem and trying to decode it, you're on a fool's journey. That's not the point of a poem, right? You know what I mean? Like the poet is so disinterested. That's kind of the power to me and why I respect poets' works. Is that a poet's work is that when you're trying to write an essay, a lot of times, you know, there's a definite way that it's finished, especially when you're working with an editor.
In this essay, I will.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. There's something you accomplish. A poem, more often than not, you know, I could slam on the keyboard and create a few indents and I could send it to like, you know, a master's program and someone could not tell me that that's not a poem. Right?
Didn't Kaveh Akbar get in trouble on Twitter for saying like a bag of dirt could be a poem and everyone was like, fuck you, bitch. I don't remember
but
what it was.
You know what I mean? For the sake of the argument.
Well,
but you know what I mean?
Yes, but here's the thing. And this is what I love about poems and what I love about in the way that I had this, if for lack of a better word, democratic idea of what a poem is and could be, is that a reading is whatever you interpret it as. A reading can be as idiosyncratic as you, and a reading is valid if that's the way you read that poem. That doesn't mean we have to agree, because I don't think any one poem has a particular type of meaning. I don't think there's one meaning for a poem. I think that it's proliferate, and it depends on... Well, we're talking about, like, what was that cologne y'all were wearing?
Santal
33.
When you're talking about, like, how it has a baseline similarity, but it changes when it interacts with your pheromones, that's a poem.
I mean, I just have an answer to the Kaveh Akbar thing about dirt. One of my favorite poems is Sharon Olds' An Ode to Dirt, which begins, "Dear dirt, I'm sorry I slighted you. I thought you were only the background for the leading characters, the plants and animals and human animals. It's as if I had loved only the stars and not the sky, which gave them the space in which to shine. I think what poetry does is it turns our attention to the things that are so often forgotten, that the bag of dirt is the literal material in which plants grow and that provide all of the energy on earth, right? Like it's like everyone else is writing big essays or books about big ideas, and poets are here being like, y'all, the dirt.
Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. in the excavation of that dirt, the poem does not have to abide by constructs of language, right? In the same way that the faggot is like, you can take your, you know, you can take your, you know, heterosexuality, you can take your hierarchical structures, like, I'm going to go be a faggot over here.
Right.
The poet gets to be like, fuck your commas. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, fuck your spell, mm-hmm. your spelling check. Like, that actually, I don't have to reckon
and also,
with
like,
that.
The meaning of literature was created in a room that did not include me or anybody of my ancestry, so like I'm gonna make this thing whatever the fuck I want it to be.
Exactly. Yeah.
I sort of think a lot, particularly when I'm reading poetry, I think a lot about fragments and fractures and holes and not.
Sure, oh my god! Is this about my impure thoughts?
You can't say holes on this podcast.
I think a lot about fractures and holes.
Well, and brokenness. And I wonder if.
This is not about my toe, isn't
it? Not the brokenness of your whole hoe. That's not what I'm always thinking about. And so I guess I just wonder if, as faggots, we're often attracted to the places where we're allowed to embrace that side of ourselves a little more wholly, where we don't... Holy. A little more fully.
Good God.
Where we don't... Oh my God, you disgusting whores.
Dennis.
Where we don't...
Language.
Where we don't... where we don't have to... put up a facade of togetherness or fullness, where those raw parts of ourselves, those hurting parts of ourselves, those trembling parts of ourselves can be completely out there. Like, as a person who writes prose and who primarily writes fiction, I always feel like even when I'm writing a fragmented sentence, the idea that I'm writing literal sentences feels like I'm putting an encasing there. Mm-hmm. And I think and there's a limitation there that I don't think is in poetry. And I think maybe I'm more scintillated by having that limitation and having to work around and within that limitation of a sentence. And there are so many different kinds of sentences that one can do. But I just think when I think of poetry, that's what I feel like I'm kind of getting to.
There's another way I think that poetry operates differently. I mean, forgive me, I don't necessarily do the types of writing that y'all do as much as y'all do them. But I always felt like there was a way in which I could know if I was good at writing prose. Like, mm-hmm. I'm effectively communicating this idea in this essay, mm-hmm. you know, because we're taught in English classes for the 5-paragraph essay. You set up the thing, mm-hmm. you do this, like, this formula. Like, okay, I could be a good journalist if I do the inverted pyramid. You know what I mean? Like, if I'm a novelist and there's a good story and there's a conflict and the characters are interesting, that's set up for, like, a good book. Mm-hmm. But I was like, how do you get good at poetry? I don't fucking know, but I know it when I read it.
But you can't, but yeah, right.
And like, I think like sometimes when Joe was talking about making something from the bag of dirt, and then we were also talking about the turn. Yeah. And I'm thinking about like this contemporary moment we're having right now, they're calling the new Native American Renaissance, which is like all of these Native people coming out the woodwork because of opportunities, because of things like the Institute of American Indian Arts, because of things like people in publishing, because of these anthologies like New Poets of Native Nations and Shapes of Native Nonfiction and stuff like that. There are more opportunities, more interest. When, with the toppling sort of Sherman Alexie, there wasn't a vacuum. There was a shit ton of people who were like, he's been hoarding that state. He's been hoarding that position. And there have been all of us for so long that have been in this game, that have been overlooked or whatever. And I just wanted to share one poem with y'all, if that's okay.
Love poetry.
Because this is like something that I think that speaks to a contemporary indigenous moment that does like one of the dirt things and definitely does a turn thing. And it's from a poem by Brandy Nalani McDougall. It's called On Cooking Captain Cook. And she's a Native Hawaiian. And I'm sorry if I don't say any of these words right, or if I have them, I've mispronounced them. I do not mean to dishonor your language. On Cooking Captain Cook. If you ask the blonde-haired concierge at the Grand Kiai, he will tell you that we ate him whole, strung his white meat on a stick, filled his mouth with apples, and slow roasted him over the fire.
The sunburned vendor selling t-shirts at Lyena will say, "We ate him too, but only certain parts. The head, the heart, the hands, wrapped in a kind of spinach and held over hot lava." The owner of the Hula Hula Bar and Grill will say, "We only ate him for lack of fine cuisine. Rubbed his skin with sea salt and boiled him in coconut milk and served him on a bed of yams." My anthropology professor, long researching ancient cultures, will offer explanations from his latest book. The white-skinned men seemed gods to those without metal or written words. By eating him, they meant to become him. But if you ask my tutu, while she waters her orchids in pro tea, she will invite you in to eat. To eat. So that's the poem. Mm. Which is like taking in, I think, something overlooked, adding the expectation.
Yeah.
Turning it at the end.
The multitude of stories.
Yeah.
The multitude of different stories.
And being like, this is what, these four, you know, strophes or whatever is what happens when other people tell our stories but us.
Yep.
And
yep.
This last one is when we get in control of our own narrative.
Yep, and that,
I think, is what's happening in a lot of groups, queer, marginalized, otherwise, and especially in like the Native poetry community that I am connected to, that I feel so seen and held and enraptured by.
I just have one question to round us out, and it's something that I think about a lot as someone who writes in multiple genres and who purposely doesn't necessarily see my writing in one genre different from another. It's like we've lived through postmodernism, right? You have fucking long-ass novels with zero plot. You have poems with a lot of plot, and poems originally were epics with tons of plot. In this world where genre sort of melts into other genre, what lessons can poets teach other writers and people living their lives? And is it important to maintain poetry as a separate entity? Does it give us something other than just calling writing?
I mean, I think in a certain poetry, I always feel like is one of those things that people turn to when they don't have the words for something. You know, when there's something, they're going through something, they're, you know, I mean, that's what we talk about, you know, people coming to poetry in their adolescence because the body is changing, things are changing, you're coming to like kind of an awakening. Everyone has those tired high school poems that they tried to do one time or the other, but that's...
I'm still writing them.
But that's, I think, us trying to make sense of something senseless, you know? And if poetry isn't there to do that, then what it, like, I think it's always going to be there. It has maintained, even as it has gone from being the original art, like dance, the original art that doesn't require instruments, that doesn't require, you know, accent. It's literally language, like literally sitting around a fire and telling stories. Those were the poems, right? And that, like, even though they're not financially viable by any means, you know, like all of these Alex Chi, Michael Ondaatje, Linda Hogan, Louise Erdrich, so many people started out as poets
and went
to other forms of writing because they're either they told different stories that they wanted to tell or they were just more lucrative financially.
Yeah.
But like that, I think there's something so ancient in the seed of poetry that is so connected to literal humanity that I don't think one can exist without the other.
Wow, beautiful place to end.
You know, I'm feeling like I'm full, but I could fit just one more thing inside of me. Dennis knows how I feel. And this week, our dessert is the seminal 1995 short film written, starring, produced, and scored by Vin Diesel.
Not scored.
Yes, no, absolutely. No, He's got a song in that movie. It's called Multifacial.
No, he does not.
By Vin Diesel, it's 95, scored by him.
Available on YouTube.
Available on YouTube far and wide. The Wikipedia description says, says the main character is a struggling actor with a tattooed arm. But it's honestly like an actor who is multiracial, who goes in between different auditions trying to be different things. People are like, you should be Italian, or, you know, you should be black, but not too black. No, we're looking for somebody darker. We're looking for somebody lighter. We wanted somebody with longer hair. We wanted somebody with dreadlocks. And so it's continually him like trying to appeal to the auditioner to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. And then there's like this it starts out with kind of like you don't really know where you are, because it starts out with this guy just talking shit, like telling a story, and it's like misogynistic and homophobic. And then you realize he's at an audition, and the people who are like auditioning him are like, we'll call you. And then he gets out later, he's talking to his agent, and he's like, I think I really fucked up in there, because I think that monologue that you made me tell was a little bit offensive, and I don't really know how I feel about it. And he goes into a different audition that was like for a commercial, and then he again laments the fact that he had this monologue that was offensive, and then immediately the guy at the audition was like, he's like, this is for a beer commercial. And he's like, we wanted like a Denzel type, you know.
Right.
Oh my gosh.
And so it's not hard to imagine that this was Vin Diesel's actual experience as an actor in auditioning. The thing that happened with this short film is that after he made it, it was picked up by Cannes Film Festival.
I don't know her.
Where it was screened to standing room only audiences.
Wow.
Eventually noticed by, I think, Steven Spielberg, and wrote a part specifically for Vin Diesel in Saving Private Ryan, which launched his career.
Wow.
So I think this is not only a good I enjoyed it. Vin is hot in this motherfucking shit. Like, he's young and hot, 95 or whatever.
A little less bulky,
but so innocent.
He's like a twunk.
Yes.
He's a twunk. Teeps, this conversation can't exist around the fact, except for the fact that you introduced us all to this movie in all of our favorite hometowns, Asbury Park, New Jersey,
where we did our food for thought summer retreat.
Worst day literally ever ending in somehow it's the even worse than what other day, because I was like too high, and you were like, we gotta watch this, and I was like, what's going on? I couldn't follow the movie at all, and I probably will never rewatch it. However, you have great taste.
But thinking about our conversation around poetry, it's a small bite. It's what, 15 minutes?
Yeah.
It sets up a sort of premise in its opening scene, and you're like, it was big time cringe, because he is a dick, you know, he's being openly awful, and you don't know that it's an audition. So there's a volta, there's a turn, right? You know, it kind of is the type of thing that could never get made for a lot of money, but that is maybe closer to self-expression than Vin Diesel will ever get.
Literally
again in
ever.
His career.
Yeah.
It was surprising to me, and it's lovely. One thing that I love with artists that I respect, I spend a lot of time reading bad books by the writers I love most, including, you know, Joan Didion, James Baldwin, Marguerite Duras, the French writer. Like, they wrote a lot of books, and like, their best books are some of the best books ever written, but they didn't, not all their books are
genius.
Right.
Genius.
Anne Sexton, did you really need to write all those? I don't think so.
But like, that as a writer and as a human, that is so informative. You get to know someone so well by their mistakes, by seeing them change over time, by seeing them as a person who tries things. That, you know, being a great artist requires failure, requires trying things that are weird and different. And it teaches you so much as an artist to see that. And I don't think this film was a failure. It's just, it's self-made. It was produced on no money.
I don't think it was a failure at all. What happened was, I think Vin Diesel, Lil Vin, was probably like going on all these auditions and realized he was not going to have a part unless he wrote one for himself.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And like, Mindy Kaling talks a lot about that. Yep. So many people talk about like, when you're outside of what they are quote unquote looking for in those, what do you call them, in between the parentheses, like the, I can't remember the exact term, but when they're on the call sheet or whatever, like we're
the
looking
call
for
type.
30s, you know, mid blah, blah, blah. You have to be like this or whatever. If you're not that type, if you're not eligible type, then you get sifted through more often than not. And I also think it's like a great example of somebody who like made something small and precise that was then legible to somebody who was going to make something bigger.
Yep.
You know,
yep,
so it's yep, like yep. the zine version of the book or something
exactly
like that.
Exactly like a zine, yeah.
Thank you. Ooh, metaphor. Yeah. Oh no, similes, yes.
It's definitely worth watching, especially
if you have an awesome Airbnb in the amazing Asbury Park.
Shut up. Oh. Go watch it on YouTube.
And the end, the thing is...
in your own home.
The last shot we get is like Vin Diesel... or Mike, rather, at a cafe, and the couple behind him, they're complaining about being actors. And one of them is like a blonde lady, and she's like, ugh, like it's just so hard because like you're supposed to be like the bimbo, you're supposed to be the whatever. And then the waitress comes to take her order, and she's like, I'll have like a bagel with cream cheese and like a coffee. And she's like, how do you want it? And she's like, you know, not too light, not too dark. And then Vin is in the foreground being like, not too light, not too dark.
Oh my God. No, brilliant. It's no. Perfect. Producer is Alex is falling out of her chair.
Bad.
It's so good.
This episode of Food for Thought is made possible by the generous, unequivocal support of Bon and Viv. I mean, Rosé.
Sacrilege.
Our new home at iHeartRadio. Our producer is Cat Mom and she's loving it. Alexandra De Palma. Our production manager is fisting badass Elizabeth D. True. Our social media manager is currently remembering a joke she made 10 years ago and losing it. Christina Tucker, I deeply identify.
Same as you.
Yes. Subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes or Fran Wears Colored Clothes. are we calling them clothes of color?
We'll cut that.
I am Tommy Teebs Pico. You can find me at Hey Teebs, HeyTeebs, on all relevant social media.
I'm Joseph Osmondson. You can find me at www.josephosmondson.com.
I'm Dennis Norris II, and you can find me on Twitter at The Earl Denden, TheEarlTenden.
I'm Fran, and I want whatever tranquilizer Dennis is on. You can find me at Fran Squish Co. on any social media you want.
Find us on Instagram as Gay Sluts Who Read, and join us on Facebook and Twitter at Food for Thought Pod, where each week we pin some questions at the top of our page to continue the discussion of this week's main topic. Sign up for our newsletter to see a list of everything we're reading and some extra delectable content at foodforthoughtpodcast.com. And finally, send your questions, thoughts, concerns, and dick pics to thoughts at foodforthoughtpodcast.com. As always, that's food, the number 4, and thoughts spelled how?
T-H-O-T.
Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.